Now, the book of Daniel, as you know, is to be considered in these three meetings. We start with chapter 1, as you would expect, the first chapter of the book of Daniel. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God, and they brought the vessels into the treasure house of his God. And the king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel, and of the king's seed, and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well favored, and skillful in all wisdom, and cunning in knowledge, and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king. Now among these were of the children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, unto whom the prince of the eunuchs gave names, for he gave unto Daniel the name of Belteshazzar, and to Hananiah of Shadrach, and to Mishael of Meshach, and to Azariah of Abednego. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. And the prince of the eunuchs said unto Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who hath appointed your meat and your drink, for why should he see your faces worse liking than the children which are of your stock? And then shall ye make me endanger my head to the king. Then said Daniel to Melzer, whom the prince of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, prove thy servants, I beseech thee, 10 days, and let them give us pulse to eat and water to drink. Then let our countenances be looked upon before thee, and the countenances of the children that eat of the portion of the king's meat, and as thou seest thee with thy servant. So he consented to them in this matter, and proved them 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, their countenances appeared fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children which did eat the portion of the king's meat. Thus Melzer took away the portion of their meat and the wine that they should drink, and gave them pulse. As for these 4 children, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. Now at the end of the days that the king had said he should bring them in, then the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king communed with them, and among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in all his realm. And Daniel continued even unto the first year of King Cyrus. So that will do for our reading. One thing that human beings have nothing whatever to do with, and that is deciding what period in the world they should be allowed to dwell on earth. And I'm sure if any of us had been selecting a time to live in the world and a place to live, the last place we would think of living and the last time we would want to have lived in it was the days of Daniel as a prince in Jerusalem. He had we would almost say, humanly speaking, the misfortune to arrive in the world at a very sad time for his people. That had nothing to do with him. We've always to remember there's much in our lives that we just don't control. and be satisfied to leave that that way. God has settled that, and let him settle it, and that's his affair. What we'll have to do, of course, is to learn to make the best of where God puts us. And that's exactly what we will try and find out from this precious book of Daniel. Now, Daniel is one man whose life spans a long period. He, as you know, was a lad possibly in his teens when the Babylonian Empire was established. And he lived throughout his existence. And right over into the next empire, the Persian Empire, he would write, as we just read at the end of chapter 1, until the days of Cyrus. That means to say that the whole 70 years of Israel's servitude to the king of Babylon, Daniel lived through it all. And that, I think, is marvelous. What we should learn from that is this, that in spite of all the dangers that he was in, and all the apparent disasters that were about to fall on him, he was still spared through the ball and was preserved right to see not only the start of the kingdom and its continuance, but right the very end of Babylonish power and glory. Now, he differs from all the other prophets in this respect, like that is up to here, up until here. But all the prophets that God had raised up in Israel, they were always men that spoke to Israel and warned them of their evils and of the ways to live. Whereas Daniel's ministry was almost entirely either a narrative of himself and his doings, but particularly his messages to foreign kings. To put it in our modern language, he was a missionary prophet. That is, his message was for foreigners. And he's the great sample of a man who God raised up to make known his name among the heathen. That is a most important side to remember, that God has an interest in mankind, wicked men as well as good men. Here's a man, Nebuchadnezzar, a wicked, cruel, ruthless man. And here's a big empire of wicked rulers of one form or another. And yet God is making his name known there. And he's sending a missionary there. And he's going to make known his name in that part. Now that's most important. Dear child of God, don't forget you have a big business on hand. And your big business in this world is making God known, but he's not known. Meeting with people that don't deserve, we might say, to know anything that's worth knowing. They're so wicked and sinful and vain. And yet God, in his wonderful way, means that those people should have a knowledge of himself and gain that knowledge through our missionary efforts. Oh, so somebody, I hadn't even thought of going to the mission field. No, well, you needn't cross the ocean or the further lands explore. You can find the heathen nearer. You can meet them at your door. You see, you don't need to go too far to meet with heathen. I often think that one of the ways that God has of reaching mankind is to send his children into circles where God is not wanted or appreciated, and in those circles they're allowed to make known his name. Then again, I think you will agree that Daniel was greatly influenced by those who went before him. Possibly we have no idea. But possibly one of the men that specially helped young Daniel was the man Jeremiah. Well, you know, Jeremiah was in close contact with the palace where this prince was reared. And therefore he had a great opportunity. Daniel had a great opportunity of benefiting by the presence of that older man, the prophet Jeremiah. Always remember that not only do men's words stay with us, but men that God hath raised up have an influence upon us. Their very character, their trials, their messages from God, they leave impressions, and their whole demeanor leaves impressions upon the mind. Jeremiah was, as you know, alive at the very time when Israel was carried into captivity. And so when this boy that we speak on in a moment or two was carried away, The prophet Jeremiah was right in the thick of the whole experience. Therefore, he was indebted to that former prophet. Dear brother, whatever else you do, get rid of this spirit of independence. Now, please do. It's distressing to see how many, and they gather a wee smothering of knowledge, and they scrape it up, and they think, well, we have it all, and nobody's any use now. We can carry on without the rest. Now, that sort of spirit is not helpful. God has so arranged it that we all need each other, and we need to benefit from one another. And all of us that are a while on the way, we owe a debt that we can never repay to those older men that are now in glory whose voices we will never hear again. Now keep that in mind. So please, try your best to get rid of that spirit of independence, either as a company or as an individual. This idea of isolationists that many have seemingly adopted and sit away up on a pedestal in cold isolation, it is neither good for them nor beneficial to those they influence as they meet with them from time to time. The prophecy of Daniel, as you know, divides into two major parts, very clearly seen. The first part is six chapters, it's equally parts, it's not often we get the chapters equal, but it's equal. And six chapters are what we might call those experiences that Daniel had, and those historical bits, those are the bits that people want to understand. But then you see, I began to think of, possibly there are young believers coming to these meetings, and you bear with them, you older folk that know it all, you just bear with them, because they don't know it all, and they might benefit from the early chapters just as much as we would try to benefit from the latter chapters. Now, it's not only divided in two parts, but the strangest thing, I suppose, about it is that it's written in two different languages. Now, don't be thinking of your authorized version when I say that, but it's like the Book of Ezra, in this respect, that not only is part of it written in Hebrew, but part of it is written in Aramaic, or Syrian, or Chaldean, whatever word you like to use, to describe the other language that was used in Babylon. Now, that's a strange thing, isn't it? That a man's writing a book, and he comes to a certain spot, and he just changes the language, and he starts writing another language. And then after he's written a while in another language, he goes back to his own language again. If you've got a letter like that, you know, you'd be all amused about it, wouldn't you? You'd be surprised about it. Why did he change his language? Why did he use the heathen language, as we might say, and it's not the religious one of his own fathers? Now, I think you will find, if you examine the part that's written, it starts in verse 4 of chapter 2, and it goes right on to the end of chapter 7. If you look at those chapters, you'll find that they have mainly to do with the heathen side of things. And I'll put it just simply like this. When he's writing to heathens and about heathens, he uses heathen language, if you'll allow that. Now, when I say that, I don't want you to do away with inspiration. That's not the point. I'll mention this in a minute. But then when he's dealing with the recovery of God's people, he goes back to their own language. Now, I think maybe that would be a wee lesson for us all, wouldn't it? That when we're speaking the gospel, we preach it in its own language, as it were. We preach it to sinners, that sinners can understand us. And when we're preaching to Christians, we preach to Christians that can understand us. We change our language, in a sense, though, of course, we're always speaking the King of English as best we can. We weren't quite clear enough. Now, I suppose you younger Christians will also know that the New Testament is not written in Hebrew. It's written in Greek. Because, you see, New Testament language has to do with the world at large. And therefore the world's language is used in its original writings. That means to say that in our Bibles, and I hope you young folk are clear on this, you have three languages introduced. You have the Hebrew language that Abraham and his posterity have carried right through. That's one of the things that Abraham brought into existence, we might say, the Hebrew language. Then you have the Chaldean language that we have intermixed both in Ezra and in this book, and a verse, I think, in the prophecy of Jeremiah. And then we have the New Testament written in Greek. Now, there's a reason for all that. God has worked. Did you ever notice that when God was speaking to Paul on the Damascus Road, he used the Hebrew language? He spoke to him in the Hebrew tongue. That must have impressed Paul greatly. To know that God would speak in, we might say, the very language of his fathers, and spoke to him in the Hebrew tongue. Now, don't ask me what language we use up in heaven, but we're all going to be able to understand each other and sing together as we were here yesterday. Well, what language that will be? We do not know. But at least there's one thing sure. There will be a language in heaven that all of us can share it. Now, as a second point or so that we brought out in the Book of Daniel. The next thing that we want to say is this. That the book opens with the first captivity of the children of Israel that were carried down to Babylon. Now for the sake of the young again. It's quite likely, I think correctly, that there were three occasions when Nebuchadnezzar took prisoners to Babylon. That covers a period of perhaps the most of 15 to 18 years, somewhere in there. So that we mustn't imagine that there just was one invasion of Palestine, and that the whole nation was carried away, and that there were lamb in Babylon. And that was the whole thing. Now that's not correct. When Nebuchadnezzar came the first time, he evidently chose the choicest in the land, the princes that Daniel was among. He came up again and he took the great mass of the people. There was a complete riddance, as it were, of the population that was worthwhile. He left a few of the people. And then, possibly with a very short space between, he came and he burnt the house and he burnt the city and he destroyed and broke down the wall. I hope you're all clear on that. That simply means, now will you please remember that there are three thoughts you keep clear in your mind now when you're studying your Bible. One is this: you keep the thought of the captivity. I should say the servitude in mind. They shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. Then you keep in mind the captivity. And then you keep in mind the desolation. If you just tell, remember those three words. The servitude, the captivity, and the desolation. I thought that was all the same thing. No, it's not. They didn't begin at the same time, but they didn't end at the same time. Oh, you're all frightened now, are you? The servitude began when Nebuchadnezzar took the first prisoners, and the nation came under the dominion of Nebuchadnezzar, even though most of it wasn't carried away, but they were under the servitude that started. And that's the 70-year servitude which ends with the decree of Cyrus in the first chapter of the book of Ezra. Clear enough? That's the servitude. The captivity began at the time when the nation was carried away. And that again lasted for 70 years. But didn't end as quick as the servitude. And then the desolation. You say, when did they begin? Well, they began when the city was burnt. The place was left desolate. I think common English would tell you that. You say, when did they end? They ended when the temple was built. Now, if you notice that in the building of the temple, they were held up for perhaps maybe 18 years or so, or for a number of years anyhow. I'm not going to try and keep numbers in my head for my mind wouldn't hold them. And you know why they were held up? Because, you see, the 70 years desolation hadn't ended. And until they were ended, and in a matter of months, the house was built. When God's clap comes to the right time, he can get things done just in his own way. Will you please keep that in mind? Oh, I think it's marvelous to think that God working through a program. Now, you men all know this. The first man to get a program was Abraham. And he got an outline of the time that Israel would spend in Egypt. And that there would be 400 years. That is from the with amazing to the coming up out of Egypt was 400 years. You're tearing up. Maybe you're not a bit tearing. Maybe not a bit happy about that. God gives the program. This is what I want you to notice. And if Israel had wept and prayed and cried and sighed and groaned, they couldn't shorten the time. God's program was projected. And then God said to Abraham, the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full. So another 38 years had to be spent in the wilderness before that cup was filled, and God would allow them to go over and destroy those nations. I want you younger Christians to get to see that your God, and my God, and the God of the Bible, is a God who can foretell the future and do it with precision and accuracy that would amaze you. And what seems to be controlled by man is altogether over, ruled by a major hand far beyond what we can understand. Now, I want to take our minds just quietly and softly to a lot. And to a number of lots. There are probably in their early teens, maybe 14 to 16. He's brought up in a palace. He's a prince. He's of royal stock. He's been well attended to. He has been what many in the nation knew nothing about. He's been educated. Because that was a favor granted to the princes and important folk in the land. Now he's going to be carried away from that circumstance. Maybe not just as pleasant in his day as many another day. But he's in the city of Jerusalem and he's round about there. And now he's lifted out of that. He's landed away down. He's body mutilated. And he's put down into captivity into Babylon. That was a big time. Took some of you young lads out of your nice home. And their mother's attendance, and your care, and your kindness. Landed you somewhere, in the heart of Africa, among savages, away into the dark corners of Russia, you would find yourself a very different boy. No longer parents to lean upon, no mother to go to, no one to advise him. There they are. They've landed in a new land. Where everybody speaks a new language. Where the whole outlook is so different. And everything's trying and testing. And everything is so oppressive that it's hard for us to feel as those lads must have felt. Powerless in the hands of an enemy. And that would put anyone to the test. Especially very young. Now you will notice more, and very quickly notice, that as sure as you start to read this first chapter, the emphasis is always on the Babylonian throne. Bring it to thee, bring the vessels out of the sanctuary of God, and bring them to the house of his God. You see, we want to keep in mind this week, if we can ever think of it at all, and that is when we're talking about Bible and Babylon and all that kind of thing, we're looking at the world religiously. The whole scene where Nebuchadnezzar was steeped in religion, but godless religion. Don't let us forget that. Wicked, godless religion, but nonetheless religious. Babylon is always an illustration, a picture of the religious world. But you know, the world has to have a religion. And the world is still being anxious about religion. And the features of it are portrayed here for us in this opening chapter of Daniel. And again, you will notice that when these young boys arrive down there, the big thought in the mind of Nebuchadnezzar was this. These are good material for our religious performance. We want the best.
We want the best.
You know, the religious world has never been satisfied with anything but the best that yet you can produce. We see in those boys the potential that is needed. And we're going to do two things with them. We're going to educate them in our language. We're going to rule them out. We're going to teach them the doctrines, the ideas of the Chaldeans. We're going to put into them a cult, an idea of things that they know nothing about, but they have the ability to absorb it. That's important. We would naturally think that all of this great king was thinking about was a lot of boys that could speak his own language. Not at all. He's not educating them in the sense of just merely teaching them a language, but he wants to get them conformed to his way of thinking and to promulgate them to, we might say, adorn his religious performances. He wants them along that line, and that's why he's so particular as to who he selects. They were, as one is using modern language for half the children, supposed to understand, and they were all people with a passion for language. Their IQs were all that. Maybe it would interest some of the boys here if they would, at some time, maybe not now, but later on in life, if you can get a concordance that deals with the original languages. If you notice that in this book of Daniel, you perhaps have the word know, and wisdom, and knowledge, and ability, and understanding. You have that word more often in Daniel than any other book in the Bible possibly. Maybe about 100 times, and about 100,000 words. Every word you can think of, as it were, is tied in to give us the idea we want able men. It's ability we want. We want knowledgeable men, we want wise men, we want shrewd men, we want capable men. That's what we're after. Now just take a glance at your Bible. I'm not asking you to read too much, but just take a glance at one of the verses and see. Look at verse 4. Children in whom was no blemish, but well favored, not as they wanted, good looks, good personalities, skillful in all wisdom, and cunning in knowledge, and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. Not only the tongue, but the learning as well. Note that. Now do you see the pairing of a word? One on the top of the other. What other? Yet, the emphasis on the fact that these words are of nature ability. They're to be an ordinary fellow. They're to be the right men. And the right stuff at that. Now just another glance to emphasize that. And look at verse 20. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians, and so on. So that you see you have wisdom and understanding and so on. That is, he wanted men of capabilities. That's the great cry, you know, in the world today, isn't it? That's why you see the religious world, if they're going to have a big campaign, they put the man's photograph on it if he's nice looking. But if he's just an ordinary five-eighth, they wouldn't put him on at all. They would spoil the picture. See, they want to have more on and the man with a nice smile, a nice countenance, you see. Well, that's that, doesn't it? Well, against it, always a lovely little man, isn't it? You could sit and go at it for hours. Now you could. What he says now does nothing, but he has a lovely face. Well, that's what evidently Nebuchadnezzar wanted nice boys to look at. And isn't he a knowledgeable man? Oh, what he knows. What he knows. Look at what he knows. He's the greatest scholar in the country. Listen to his learning. Isn't that still being emphasized? Yes, you hardly get a man's meetings announced in the religious world so many letters after his name. What's that to do? Because if the preaching was going to mean anything, the letters were going to mean anything to his preaching. But you see, that's to impress the people. Now, this man's no numbskull. This man has got the, he has got the grain. He has got the grey matter. He's the boy. He knows it. That's the world's difference. We want a man with knowledge. Whether he knows God or not, he knows a different matter. Whether he's a fellowship with the Almighty or not, it's a different matter. As long as he has knowledge. That's the main thing. We want to impress the importance of knowledge. Indoctrinating young men is a very solid thought, isn't it? Putting ideas into young men. Oh, I think that to me is very sad. To poison a man's thinking. To ruin a man with ideas in his mind that will be his ruination in time. And if he continues that way, he'll be ruined for eternity. I judge that that is something that should make us shudder. Here are young men. And if they left, if they had not had a knowledge of God and truth in the truth, they have reached their teens, they would have been ruined for the rest of their life. And that I judge to be most important. Then the next thing is this. Now, in order to keep up their good appearance and their healthy look, and possibly to develop their physique, the king decided that he would select a special diet for them. And he said they were to receive their portion from the king's meat. That is to say, the boys, the captives, were going to eat the king's meat. And that was important. By the king's meat. And you couldn't have been better. Couldn't have been better. I know that most of prison fare is not too good. And people carried into captivity are usually fed on the meanest. Oh, I often think of those prisons like for the starved men there during the war. I was in a house from Austria or Hungary when they'd been captured during the Second World War. And he told me that every 4 weeks they went in through a doctor, and the lady doctor, and she pinched the back of her neck, and if there was any flesh between the skin, it was set for another muscle. And the last test they had was until the two skins rubbed close together. And when they rubbed close together, then she said, "That was, that's enough. You can go." And they were done. They never recovered, or they died usually. As a result of that, some of them started to eat too quickly, and then their food resulted. They starved a slice of bread in the deck, cutting timber in an old pit with a cell, up and down until the poor men were leaving. And just, and that's in our own day and generation. And I was out about the outskirts of Vancouver, and some of the listeners that might have been to that man's house if he's still alive, who had that better experience. But that's not how these captives are going to be treated. No, no. They're going to get the best that the king can provide. Why? Because he wants to see them producing their nice appearance and keeping up their good looks. And he wants them to be fat and flourishing on his diet. Why the boys didn't eat it? Of course, as somebody posted those old fellows in those days, they were kinds of tell you, it's not a bit of it for a Ghanaian. Later on, we read that he made them with night wine, so that he was neither a vegetarian, nor was he a teetotaler, as we might put it in the stronger sense. No, that wasn't the point at all. Why did they refuse the food? Mind you, it's a time when you can eat it a bit, when you're in your team. And it is no great well, if you've got a voice down in their teams at the table, mind you, they can clean up a bit. And a wee bit of meat would go well at that age, wouldn't it? The old fellow, yeah, you know, he wouldn't mind. Maybe his teeth not too good, he wouldn't go well if it was taken from him or not. But the young man, you know, he would like it. Why did they not take it? They knew. In their conscience, they understood that that had been offered to idols. That was defiling meat. And by eating the king's meat, they were having fellowship with his idolatry. And with a good conscience, they couldn't take it.
that was something, isn't it? There was nobody there to take roots from them, and there was nobody taking their photograph and saying, I saw him doing it. And there was nobody clipping a wee bit out of the newspaper and saying, did you see where so-and-so was doing this or doing that? There was nobody watching them at all. Not a one of them. And there wasn't one about the palace where they ever said a word to them, only just that great boys, you're getting a nice meal today. They'd have been very happy with them. There was no one to detect them. There was no one to run away home and say they deceived a grateful thing. Hebrews sitting eating idolatrous food. You would wonder they hadn't a conscience about it. No, nobody knew anything about it. I mean, nobody would care. This was going to put the man in charge of them. I was going to say the principal of the college, but that's really what it amounts to, for this was the Royal College. I suppose you always noticed that they like to get the word royal beside the college, even the Royal College of Nurses. Did you ever notice that? And the Royal College of this, and the Royal College of that, and the Royal College of something else. Did you ever notice you're standing in the army for the purpose? Oh, they'd have the royal attitude. Well, this was the Royal College, you say. It was the King's College. But like they are, at the front, you know. The Royal College. Yes. This principal of the Royal College here began to worry about himself. He says, you know, you boys are not as nice looking and as favorable looking and as well nourished as the other boys. I'll get into trouble because I shouldn't have let you off with this. Well, my old Daniel doesn't put it too strong. Tommy just says you just let us test. We have a preliminary test in 10 days. I didn't know maybe the food would affect you as quickly as 10 days, or maybe it's slower than that. But in 10 days, just you have a look at us, you see how we do. And after 10 days on the vegetables, on the, I was going to say solid, or whatever you like to prove, you know, like these trapeze and so on. Not the one that means, trapeze, as you know, and beans are not a good thing for slimming, but what they had in the matter and they all that they required, and they partook of this fruit, and these seeds or whatever they partook of, they nourished them up, and they were looking fair and hotter at the end of 10 days. Dear brethren, I wonder if we know that our God can not only give us strength, but he can bless the food he gives us. And we all do it. I hope we do it thankfully. We bow at the table, and we bow our heads, and we thank God for the fruit. They can take their meat with singleness of heart. And we can not only thank him for providing it, but we can also thank him that he can bless it to us when we eat it. For we need his blessing with our food, as well as blessing him for giving it to us. Then again, you will notice that these boys were introduced into change. Now we listen carefully. Babylon was trying to change their name. Babylon was changing their food, but they weren't taking that. Babylon was changing their thinking. And Babylon was changing their language. And that's that to me big. Did you know that when they just wanted to change their name, they put names on people that are alive and everything. You all know that. They're calling names that are not in the scriptures. Names perhaps to honor some great leader, or to honor some great doctrine, or some name like that, but they're not in the Bible. Now, all the names that these boys had, in some way or other, connected them with the Lord. That is, their parents, when calling them the name, they introduced the idea of God or the Lord into their name. Now, for the sake of you young Christians, because we all are young at one time, don't forget that when you see a name in your Bible ending with E-L, that last two letters, those last two letters indicate that that's God, whatever the first bit of it. The name, for instance, Beth-El is house. Beth is house, and El is God. So wherever you get El at the end of a name, Ezekiel, Daniel, any of those key El's at the end, that always is God. When you get IRH at the end of a name in the Old Testament, such as Isaiah, or Jeremiah, or
Zedekiah or Zechariah, the IRH, that has always to do with the war. And whatever the first bit will have to be the meaning of the name. So there's no difficulty there. I mean, it wouldn't have done, you know, in the quota of young boys called on God's name. They'll be reminded of God every time their names were called. Every time the rubric was called, there'd be a rubric. Every time you were called for the name, to have God's name mentioned in the quota of the name. What did the principal of the school do? What did he do? He just changed their names and put heathen names in. Instead of the name of God. That is, he brought in the names of the angels. I mean, their names in some way or other, I'm not going to interpret them all for you, though I have a note of them at home, as to what they mean. But he changed the names so as to put heathen ideas every time they were called. Now, people don't think very much of the angels. See, what's what we call the Christian? The Bible calls them Christian. Calls them believers, calls them saints, calls them children of God. Well, those are names that will fit all the Christian, in all the world, but anyway. What do you put sectarian on them? You're nothing. Is that
particular?
Is that older? I wonder. You're taking the name away from them. But God has given them, and you're using worldly names to describe people that God never used, but the Bible doesn't authorize you to do so. What's the way you think of the Lord's people? Because we have got to remember that God has given names to us, and we should be thankful for them, and ashamed of them, and we should use them with care when we're speaking of our fellow believers. In that way, we don't cause any division amongst the saints by labels. Now, there came this other one. 3 years. You know, it's very like the length of time you spend for getting a degree, isn't it, at the university. A 3-year course, I would usually then, if you take it. No, there's the way you get a 4-year course. If you go for to be an architect, you maybe get a 6-year course and 2 years more to maybe get a bit of practice. And if you're a doctor, you get something about the same. But 3 years is the common period for taking a degree. So these boys, we might say, they had passed their examination, they had entered the college, and they were given 3 years to do their learning. On the examination, they came, and they went in before they came. Did they come? Keep looking through. I don't know how you, of course, we have no idea what it was like, but for a human being, for a young boy, maybe in his 17th, 18th year, to stand before Nebuchadnezzar, you know, the very thought of it would have made you shudder. You know, they talk about the nervous examination, nervousness. Is that what you call it? I might give a name like it for it, but you get nervous to exam. I think I am going to share an
nothing that I first need to say the word,
and your head was off, you know. Henry Woody Slew, Henry Woody Temple, he didn't worry about a man losing his life. He stood before me. Never did I even eye look a specimen of humanity like this before. He had never seen the leg of him before.
He couldn't question their ability. He couldn't question their success. He couldn't doubt for a moment that they had been all that he expected them to be.
What little did he know that he was standing in the presence of those that were going to educate him in a very short time. Mind you, dear men, you need to be careful. You need to be careful. Here's a big man, big in his own estimation, big in his ideas, big in his adventures, big in his successes, big in his triumphs, big in every sense. And before all's over, he's going to learn lessons from that man. Did you know, dear child of God, that you have a knowledge that the greatest men in the world know nothing about? Knows nothing about. That you could sit down beside the great fish.
We can actually meet with those that are viewed in humanist fashion as great men. And yet, when it comes to eternal things, you know nothing. You know nothing whatever.
Isn't it dreadful? But to think of the darkness that's in the world.
And to think that we possess the light. And you say, but if those boys go in and preach to the demon, then we have to learn, God willing, very soon, that God wills to bring about open doors. Now, I hope we appreciate this, because we need a lot of wisdom on these things. You see, some men are making me into a shirt and everybody's with me. I'm preaching at everybody's with me. I'm doing that. I don't think exactly that that's the way it's in the Bible. Now, I know we're to be instant in season and out of season. But I can see in my Bible that God starts machinery murmur to bring into life and to bring into opportunity those that would serve him and those that he has a fitted to serve. So that the very movement of the king's mind was so ordered by God, as we see in the word of God tomorrow night, so that his very dreams will be. Now those very dreams, as it were, the dream would be the very instrument that God would use to bring his men into promise. Now, let me get that well over into your mind, because I think you maybe haven't grasped what I'm saying. God had no nation in the old economy for men and women's name, and that nation is Israel. He had a number of missionaries that he sent out from that nation to other lands to make known his name. He sent Joseph down into Egypt. You know that. And Joseph's example must have been a great cheer to these young men. And before they had finished, Joseph had made known in his image the name of the Lord. You hear that? Now he sent Moses into Egypt to make known his name. Now he's sending these Hebrews, and particularly Daniel, into Babylon to make known his name. Missionaries, where are they from? But in each case, God wrought in the lands where he brought his servants to open the door for their testimony to be maintained. I hope we're grasping. That is, God brought the hammer into Egypt to bring that to the Nebuchadnezzar. God brought the dream into Nebuchadnezzar to bring Daniel into view and to make his name known. And you see, the Persian Empire also needed a missionary. As you see, and Daniel in the dance then became the missionary to the Persians. God made his name known to the heathen king. Bring that back to our how does God look now? What's he doing? He brings people into circumstances where they need to repeat it a bit older. I wonder, are we aware that many of them have a heart for the gospel? We have hardly never think of nobody. Oh, that God would make us. Wouldn't it be to see that he's moving to bring people into conditions where they would rather hear, but otherwise they wouldn't listen. And that's what he did. But in the book of Daniel, now we have to go through the play. Listening shall be paid.